So I really have three goals today, and this is really just an inoculation to give you some of the language. And I come on rounds, and I do a lot of work with geriatrics, so we've had these discussions in the past. But obviously, geriatrics is a hotbed for ethical issues. And I have three goals. One is how to, by the end of this session, you'll be able to do three things. One is you'll be able to recognize what constitutes an ethical dilemma in geriatrics. And that seems like a simple thing, but actually by being able to recognize that it is an ethical dilemma and what the context, nature, and form of the problem is, that will go a long way to recognizing why you're having a difficult time resolving it and how you will go about trying to resolve it. So one is to recognize what is an ethical dilemma. Two is to differentiate and distinguish philosophical ethical approaches from secular legal approaches, from human rights approaches, and from religious approaches. And then third, which is just the start, is to give you some substantive principles and some procedural approaches to trying to deal with and resolve these problems, okay? To come up with better rather than worse resolutions, if you will. So there are three goals, and we'll see how we do. The first question is, assuming you have some sense of what ethics is, and we'll define it in a minute, but obviously it deals with should or ought problems, value judgments, questions around right or wrong conduct. So you have some semblance of that. The first question is, why today? Why is there such interest, concern, and obviously these issues of medicine, healthcare problems have gone back to Hippocrates and earlier, but there's particular resurgence of interest and concern about ethics today. So why? Okay. So there's a question of partially because of our success. One of the things that we noticed, it wasn't until about 1910 that you had a better than 50% chance of doing better if you went to a random healthcare provider than if you didn't go to one at all. By the way, many people think it's not much different today. But the point is medicine as an efficacious undertaking is a fairly modern onset. And I include efficacious, meaning pharmaceuticals, as well as all the other things that are available. And so what could be done was no longer synonymous with what should be done. In 1910, what could be done was pretty synonymous with what should be done. There wasn't a lot to do. But today, we have an enormous amount of potentially effective and beneficial. And so the question is, how do we decide who should get it and what should be done? So, and should is the ethics problem. So that's what we're going to talk about, the should question. Not what has been done, not what is being done, or even what could be done is not my concern, but what should be done. What should have been done, what should be done in the present, and what should be done in the future. By the way, the other issue of access and allocation, which is a question of justice, is also a big issue, partially because of success. People want access to it. And so that's a fairly modern onset also. Because you didn't find people in the 1800s demanding access to bloodletting and purging. It wasn't such a good thing. But today, because we have potentially effective and beneficial things, the question is who's going to decide who should get what? At a micro allocation level, we have one bed, or geriatrics bed, and we have six people who need access to it. And how do we decide who should get access to it? And oftentimes in this society, because we are fairly wealthy, we try to finesse or trump that by building a million ICU beds. And then we just have the question going from a micro level to a macro level, which is should we put our money into preventive care, into outpatient medicine, into inpatient medicine, or into healthcare at all? In developing countries, obviously, you get much more by giving food and shelter and simple vaccinations and what have you. So why today? One is that the question of technology and the use and appropriate use of technology, the should question is not synonymous with the can question. Just because we can use technology doesn't mean we should use them. Justice questions. Other questions such as benefit and harm, which are classic ethical problems, are not so clear today. Because what constitutes benefit, a lot of the technologies cause a lot of harm. And we have to balance what is harm and what is benefit, and that becomes quite complicated today. So we have questions of autonomy, we have questions of technology, we have questions about who should decide. And we have taken that very seriously. Coming out of the 60s, the empowerment movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, and the patients' rights movement all said essentially the same thing, which is that if decisions are going to be made about me, that I need information, and I need to be able to make decisions. I need to have that information. So that was a response to paternalism, which actually the politically correct word is now parentalism, but paternalism, which is says that I know what's in your interest better than you do. And in 1950, a study was done of doctors, and they were asked how many of them told their patients they had cancer. 1950, how many do you think? Yeah, less than that. But, you know, in 2011, you couldn't find a doctor who wouldn't tell you that. I mean, even though we might have some rare circumstance where that could be justified. The point is that that's an enormous change in attitude. And part of that comes to taking autonomy seriously, taking patients' rights seriously, taking the idea that people need to make their own decisions about what constitutes the good end. It's part of the whole spectrum of things. So I'm just trying to give you some basic reasons why today we have such interest and concern. So questions of technology, questions of autonomy and who should decide, which we'll talk about, questions about benefit and harm, questions about justice, and also a recurrence of interest in, or for want of a better word, kind of humanistic notions. Part of the atomization, part of the specialization, people say that they want to be treated as the whole person. And that's been a resurgence of interest in the humanistic aspect of care, the holistic aspect, the primary care aspect, and also the religious and theological questions, which have come up in the context of what should be done. So the question is, what is ethics? So how would you define ethics? By the way, let me give you a quick aside. Morality and ethics in Western culture is used pretty synonymously. Okay, they're actually a little bit different definitions. Morality is the tradition of beliefs around right or wrong human conduct. But ethics is the philosophical discipline. So how would you define ethics? Well, dilemmas, yeah. But what does ethics deal with?
Right and wrong.
Right and wrong. Go ahead. So ethics deals with should or ought questions. So ethics, normative ethics, and we're going to distinguish normative ethics from descriptive ethics in a minute. But normative ethics, normative meaning to take a position, right? It deals with the nature and justification of principles or arguments to decide what should or ought be done. The nature and justification. The key word being justification. That's what ethics is about, is trying to give the reasons, the justifications, looking at the strengths, the weaknesses of the arguments. So normative ethics requires an argument, requires some reason, some justification. And that's what ethics is about, trying to look at the justification, the argument, weighing its strength, its weakness, its compatibility, its consistency, and its strength. Okay? That should be distinguished from descriptive ethics, which is a non-normative form of ethics, which describes the values that people do hold. Okay? Not whether they should hold them, why they hold them. So descriptive ethics is what the Boston Globe does. They take a survey of a society and say, euthanasia. What do you think? Oh, it's good. We should do it. We shouldn't do it. And they write, 95% of people think that you should do. That's describing the ethical values that people do hold. In that sense, it's empirically true or false. They either do hold or they don't. But that's not what we're interested in the medical world primarily. We're interested in the reasons. Okay? And one of the big pearls is you can't answer a normative ethical question, should we treat this geriatric patient, by using purely descriptive answers. The fact that that's what we've done, the fact that that's what we've got, even that's what everybody does not answer the question, what should be done. That requires some argument, okay? That's a pearl. You got that? Descriptive ethics describe the ethical beliefs people have. Normative ethics gives some reason or justification, okay? By the way, general normative ethics deals with general principles. And applied normative ethics, which is what medical ethics is applying. It's not that there are different ethics, legal ethics, clinical ethics. It's all the same ethics, but it's being applied in a particular arena. Now, the next thing we need to do is to talk about a dilemma, because that's mostly what we deal with, are dilemmas, okay? And so we have to define what constitutes a dilemma, because this is the answer to the first question, which is, how do you recognize you're dealing with an ethical dilemma? So we're going to try to define what an ethical dilemma is, because that'll lead us to the reason why we're having a difficult time trying to resolve it and how to go about trying to resolve it. Okay? So first of all, what makes something a choice? A choice. You have to have two possible choices of, right? In order to have a dilemma, you have to have at least two possible choices of action. Right? Two possible choices of action. That just makes it a choice. What makes it a dilemma? An ethical choice is that there's a choice between values. Values are the key word for ethics, right? So it's a value choice, not just a choice. Like, I went with my son, who was visiting me last night, to the ice cream store. And if I tell you, he spent an hour testing each one of the ones, you know, that was a choice for him, but that was not a big moral dilemma. Okay? That was a choice. But what makes it an ethical choice is the value judgment. But that doesn't make it a dilemma either. What makes it a dilemma? It's a certain type of ethical choice. A moral dilemma, an ethical dilemma, is a choice between at least two possible choices of action. At least two possible choices. One of the big mistakes medical people make is to assume there are only two choices. When there are multiple choices, and to make it to narrow it down at that level is already to make a flawed analysis. Okay, so there has to be at least two possible choices of action where people place significant different values on something about the choice. Underline the word significant. That's what makes it a dilemma. That's the difference between the ice cream problem and termination of life support. All right? Or to put it another way, there are both good, strong, and persuasive arguments both for and against the choices available. There are both good, strong, and persuasive arguments both for and against the choices. That's why it's a dilemma. Okay? So there's another pearl. One of the easiest ways to know you're dealing with a dilemma in medicine, an ethical dilemma, is that everybody's upset. And the reason why everybody's upset is because there are good, strong, and persuasive arguments, which is why you go home at night and you say, oh my God, should we do this? Should we do that? I think we should have done this. We should have done that. There's strong values. There's strong feelings. And people feel compelled to try to do the right thing. And it's not clear. Okay? So there are good, strong, and persuasive arguments both for and against the choices. Now, oftentimes in medicine, the choices are framed as one choice being right and one choice being wrong. So the abortion debate or the euthanasia debate is often framed as one choice being right and one choice being wrong. But most of the dilemmas that we deal with in geriatrics in particular are not framed that way. They're framed as both choices being right or both choices being wrong, but you can't do both of them. Okay? This is what's called a tragic choice. Okay? There are good, strong, and persuasive arguments, and both of the choices are good choices, but you can't do them both. So let me give you an example to flesh this out a little, because it's a compelling one, and because it's around school, the new year starting pretty soon for the students. So there was a case of a young man who came from another country, a college student came from another country, which is an interesting cross-cultural issue, and we could talk about relativism and values and what have you. Anyway, he came from another country, and he arrived at the University of California at Berkeley, and it was the first week of orientation. And what happens during orientation? And this is a Rorschach test. When I teach in the School of Theology or the Philosophy Department, I get different answers, so we'll see what your answer is. What happens during the first week of orientation before school starts? What? Parties. There you go. Now we, that's good. Parties. So some people say, well, you get ready for school, you get your books, you know. It's parties. There are parties. And so this young man went to a party. Okay? Party before school started. And he was at the party, and he met this girl, and he started to dance with her. And this was wonderful. And at the end of the evening, she kissed him on the cheek. And he thought this was wonderful. They get married, they have many children, and live happily ever after. So he decided he wanted to call her to see her again, but he didn't know where to find her. So he went on Facebook. I know. I'm with it. He went on Facebook, and he found out how to get a hold of her. And he called her on the phone and said, "I'd like to go out with you." And she said, "No." And he said, "No, you forgot. I went the other night. We danced. You kissed me on the cheek. Everything was wonderful. We're going to get married. Have many children." She says, "No, I don't want to talk to you," and hung up on him. And he called her again. She said, "Don't ever call me again," and hung up. And he became more and more distraught and had good insight, and he went to the campus psychiatrist. Okay. The psychiatrist said, "What seems to be the problem?" He said, "Well, I met this girl, and she danced, she kissed me on the cheek, everything was wonderful, we were married, had many children, I called her, she hung up, I called her, and I think I'm going to go kill her." Okay? Now, there's an epistemological problem, which is a question of knowledge and certainty, because it's hard to predict the future, right? Like Woody Allen has some line about that, but it's hard to predict the future. But let's assume that you have reason to believe that this is possible, that this is true, okay, that he really has the intent to go out and kill her, okay? Now, I would suggest you, the clinician, are faced with a dilemma, okay? So let's define what the dilemma is. What? So there has to be at least two choices of action, right? So, but what is the dilemma?
Patient confidentiality, or if you're going to break it,
Okay, so that's a very sophisticated way of looking at it. There are at least two choices. By the way, there may be many other choices, but one choice is to so-called maintain confidentiality. We'll talk about that, right? We'll talk about why you would might want to do that. And the other is to try to prevent somebody from being murdered, right? So let's deal with the murder part first. Is that a good principle? Prevent people from being murdered, particularly if they don't know that somebody's out to kill them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't say how we're going to do it yet, but is that a good principle?
Yes.
That's a pretty good principle. I think we could all agree on that. The other principle is maintaining confidentiality. As a general principle, as a general rule, is that a good thing to maintain confidentiality?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, here we go into the ethical theory, which is in three weeks in my other class, and we're going to do it in two minutes here. Their ethical theory, which is why should we maintain confidentiality? One argument is because at the utilitarian argument, which is at the individual level, the reason is because it won't be good for that individual person, or it will be good to maintain confidentiality, right? Right. Or we might say, even in this case where we might want to breach confidentiality because of the utility, because of we might, as a rule, we might not want to do that because that will be in the long run not good for people, right? So if every time, if Sharon comes to see me in my psychiatric practice, and every time she sees me, I write a little note in the Boston Globe, you can't believe what she came to tell me about, it's unbelievable. That's what they call a little bit of a deterrent. Right? And so the idea is that if everybody tells people about what's going on, then nobody comes and sees their psychiatrist. We have a bunch of crazy people running around, and that's not good for people in general, right? So that's one reason, by the way, confidentiality might be good, because of the outcome, either as a rule or as an, doesn't matter what the outcome is, but as a rule or as an act. But there's other reasons why we might want to maintain confidentiality independent of the outcome. Because we made a promise, right? Because we told the person that we weren't going to tell anybody, okay? Which is part of the reason why we generally don't say absolutely. But anyway, we're told, and therefore we have a duty. And therefore the problem is not trying to maximize the outcome in weighing things, but trying to weigh the duties one has, because there may be different duties involved. That's called a deontological or duty-driven. So we're not going to go into the depth of this analysis, but there are outcome-based approaches, there are action, rights, duties-based approaches, there are virtue-based approaches, there are different approaches, okay? Anyway, so in this particular case, how might you try to analyze this case, yes?
Also, what's the law on that?
Okay.
If something,
okay.
Are you bound?
Right, and we'll hold on to that in a minute, we'll talk about the law, but I'm not concerned about the law. The first and always thing you need to ask is what the right thing to do is. And then later on, if there are constrictions about the law, remember the law is, there are conscientious objection, there's good law, there's bad law, we'll talk about the law. But the first question is never what the legal question is. By the way, when you're dealing with a dilemma, the law generally doesn't have any better sense of how to resolve these issues than you do anyway, because it's a moral dilemma. And the judges, and having testified many, many times, the judges don't want to hear it, the judges are unclear. But anyway, we'll hold on to the law. But let's deal with the ethics part of it first. So what do you think? That's why it's a dilemma. But many people would argue that in this case, the outcome might be better, if we were looking at outcome, to breach confidentiality to maintain this person's life. On the other hand, some would argue again, in the long run, that may not be so good if people generally don't believe. So that's one outcome-based approach. Another might say that we have a duty, and the duty to protect life may be higher than the duty to make confidentiality. But that's what makes it a dilemma. That's what makes it a dilemma. Now, in fact, is that in this particular case, which is a real case, he actually did go out and kill her. And that was a bit of a problem. But the point is that the psychiatrist did have a belief that this person was going to commit the act. So that's an important fact. He didn't have to believe that. He didn't have to think that. And by the way, the American Psychiatric Association, when this came to a legal case, because the guy was sued, said that we can't predict the future. American Psychiatric Association, right? However, in this particular case, he did predict the future. And so what he did was he let the person go, and then he had second thoughts and sent out the police. And the police went and knocked on his door and said, "Are you so-and-so?" And he said, "Yes, we have reason to believe that you're going to kill somebody." He said, "Nah." So they said, okay, being the great psychiatric insight of the campus police. And they went back and told the doctor that he said he wasn't going to do it. The doctor said, okay, all right. So this was a screw-up in many, many ways. But the point is that the ethical dilemma is what I'm trying to get at, is a choice between at least two possible choices of action. And what the ethics is about is trying to make the justified argument. Okay, make the justified argument. By the way, what probably should have been done, I think probably the third alternative would be to try to commit him, right? Which will hopefully would be to make, you breach some confidentiality, but the bottom is you can maintain confidentiality and also protect this girl, right? In fact, I would argue that the guy who committed the murder has a cause of action saying that that's why he went to the psychiatrist to begin with, was to be protected. Now he's not so good for him either. He's going to jail. Okay. So anyway, that's a moral dilemma, an ethical dilemma. Okay. Now let's take a brief. So what is an ethical dilemma? This is what's called review. The more time it goes through your hippocampus, the better. An ethical dilemma is, well, first of all, what is ethics? What is normative ethics? Normative ethics deals with, you can read what you wrote. There we go. Now we get the A student. Okay. So that's the normative ethics. And an ethical dilemma is a choice between at least two possible choices of action where people place significant different values on something about the choice, or there are good, strong, and persuasive arguments before and against the choice. Okay, hold on to that. That was goal one of the learning objectives. Okay, goal two is to distinguish ethics from law, religion, and from human rights. Okay. So the first thing is the goal of ethics is to try to decide what the right thing to do is, right? The law is quite different. First of all, the law, there's good law and bad law. There were laws in this country that said that women couldn't vote until there was a constitutional amendment. There were laws about slavery. There were laws in Nazi Germany. So the law is not the same thing as ethics. Just because you follow the law doesn't mean you're being ethical, and just because you don't follow the law doesn't mean you're not being ethical, right? But the source of ethics, of general philosophical ethics, is people, rational, reasonable people. Okay. So anybody can argue about what the right thing to do is. There's no special voice. There's no special knowledge. And my argument is no better than Plato's argument, except for Plato may have more intelligent things to say. So you say, wow, that makes a lot of sense, right? So everybody has a place at the table. That's its strength, philosophical ethics. That's perhaps its weakness also, which is everybody has a place at the table, right? But everybody can come, right? And the goal is to try to come up with better rather than worse resolutions, right? And it applies to everybody, universally. So if we make an argument that what should be done is that we should breach confidentiality in this particular case here, and now I step over here, what is the ethical argument? Is it the same or does it change? It's the same. We would argue that like cases should be treated alike insofar as they are alike and not alike in morally significant ways. Okay? Now that's quite different from the law. First of all, the source of the law, we'll talk about US law, is what? Well, the ruling class. So not everybody can make the law. Clearly not everybody can interpret the law. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court, in one vote, can change the law for the whole country. Okay? So we don't generally, and it's generally, without getting into political philosophy, it generally tends to be the people in power who make the law. They generally tend to maintain the law the way it is. Okay? We don't go out to the homeless patients and say, you make the law. All right? Because we get a very different set of laws. But the point is that the law is not open to everybody to make or to interpret. Even in a democracy, right, we elect people, but they can't make the law themselves, right? So the source is different. Who does the law apply to? We said ethics applies to everybody. Who does the law apply to? The law applies to whoever the law applies to, meaning that it's jurisdictional. So you can't answer the question about what the law says without knowing where you are. All right? So the law of Massachusetts is the law. It's not the law of Rhode Island. And the law of the U.S. is not the law of Mexico, okay? So it's jurisdictional. So the question is, when they say is legal or not, you can never answer that question without saying where, when, right? And it can change overnight, okay? So the law is jurisdictional, right? and the law applies to whoever the law applies to. The goal of the law is also quite different than ethics. The goal of the law is to set minimum standards to maintain social order. All right? It's not nuanced. It's to maintain the minimal standards, such that you're not an outlaw. But by the way, you can be a pretty bad person and not be an outlaw. Right? So the law is quite different. One of the good things about the law, though, is that the law is supposed to be clear and specific. That's what appeals are often about, right? And the law is enforceable, assuming it's good law. Okay? But the law is not the same thing as ethics. So, are there new fellows here? No? People have walked along the Charles, right? So if you're walking along the Charles River, and you see somebody drowning, oh, help me, I'm going to drown, right? And you're walking along, and the facts are important. You have nothing better on your hands to do. You have no risk to yourself, and that's all you need to do is throw out the little tube, whatever, and you save the person, and they go on to be a famous bioethicist, and otherwise they drown. If you walk by and don't do anything, do you break a law? No. Not unless you have a big sign that says, I'm a lifeguard, right? Or you go out and you try to help the person, because if you do that, then the other people will see that and not, maybe not. But you don't break a law. So that's the law, right? But what might you say from an ethics perspective? What the hell kind of person is it? It takes 2 seconds, you save this person's life, otherwise they die. So we can see that the ethics may demand things of you, positive, not just what the law says, which is generally what you're not supposed to do unless you enter into a contract. The law just says what you're not supposed to do. Ethics is much richer. Ethics might say that you actually have a duty to do good, not just not to do harm. Okay? So that's the law. It's different from ethics. Okay? The last one is religion, which comes up a lot in ethics work as well. And it's a little more complicated because there are religious laws and religious ethics. But ultimately, one thing about religion is quite different. And that is at least in Western tradition, the source of the knowledge is, so we said the source of the knowledge in ethics is just people. The source of the knowledge in law is the ruling class, you know, whoever makes the law. The source of the knowledge in religion is faith, F-A-I-T-H, and or some kind of revealed source, God and Judeo-Christian tradition, the Yin-Yang. The point is that it may not be accessible to everybody. That doesn't mean it's bad, that doesn't mean it's wrong. In fact, a lot of the principles are the same. But we can't, ultimately, when you ask the question, how do you know what you know, I'm often on national panels, or sometimes international panels, where people are asked to talk about ethical dilemmas, and everything is just fine until they ask the question, how do you know what you know? And then the priest says, well, you know, I read this, and, you know, God spoke to me, and then the philosopher says, you know, I fought the big thoughts, and the lawyer says, I looked at this. The point is that it may not be accessible to everybody, religion, okay? May not be accessible, and therefore that's why it's hard to have a society that runs on religion unless you have a church state, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so religion is another element which is very important, but it may not be the ability to have public policy based on it. Religion, by the way, is also complicated. Let me give you an example. I was recently called down to the emergency room about a patient who was a Jehovah's Witness and was refusing blood. Okay. So, you know, the case, the person gets hit by a car, they come into the emergency room, and the docs say that, you know, you need blood. Without blood, assuming the facts are all correct, you need blood. Without blood, you'll die. 100% certainty, and with blood, you'll live. And the patient says, I don't want any blood, and what do we say? Well, first we ask why, and they say they're Jehovah's Witnesses, and we say, fine, right, to refuse treatment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all right? Okay, and that's that, okay? The same person goes out, gets hit by a car, arrives in the emergency room, is bleeding out, and you say, you need blood, without blood you live, without blood, and you say, and they say they don't want blood, and you say, why? And they say, well, God spoke to me this morning, and said, don't. Now, God spoke to somebody somewhere along the line, right? That's what Jehovah's Witness is all about, right? Yep. All right? And we say, what do you mean God spoke to you? You mean like you read the scriptures and God spoke to you? Or do you mean like God moved you? Or do you mean like God said, hello, you know? This is not so simple, not so easy, okay? And we'll get back to that in terms of religion. Okay, so that's the difference between ethics, law, and religion. That's the second bullet point. The third, which is a whole discussion, which we really need cases to do, is the procedure. Okay, and let's just go through the procedure, and then we'll leave that outline. So here's the procedure. The first question is, how to when we're dealing with a console, for instance, the first question is, what is the dilemma? All right? And when we're in the ethics world, what we're looking for is what kind of dilemma? So we're not looking for the question. If we get called for an ethics consult and say, what's the law on this? That's a legal question. You might have to go, all right, I don't think that's necessarily the right question, but that's a different question. But what's the question that we're looking for? What should be done? To framing a problem or a dilemma, right? Not what can be done. So oftentimes I get a call and say, can we disconnect the ventilator? I suppose you can. I mean, that's not probably not the problem, though. The problem you really want to ask is, should we, right? That's why there's a dilemma, right? Okay, so once we define the dilemma descriptively, it's a choice between at least two possible choices of action, what the choices are, then the next question we ask is, what is going on? This is in the handout. What is going on? And so here's a pearl. Good ethics start with good facts. Okay? If you have the facts screwed up, you're going to have a problem with the ethical analysis. Even if you do the best ethical analysis, even when you have the facts, you're going to have a tough time because it's a dilemma. But if you don't have the facts, if you get the wrong patient, you get the wrong diagnosis, should we do chemotherapy or should we do lumpectomy or should we do for breast cancer, but you have misdiagnosed the breast cancer, that's probably a relevant fact. Okay? So what's going on? And so what are the things we look for? And we try to make this as value-free as possible. What's going on? What are we looking for? The patient, the medical team, who the doctors are, who the primary care doctor is, who the clergy are, who are all the people relevant in this person's moral world, what the diagnosis is, realizing that there's uncertainty, what the prognosis is, what the ongoing treatment is, et cetera. Defining what the case is, what's going on. What's the next question? Yeah, what can be done? What can be done? So what are the options? What are the various choices that are available? At this point, we don't want to decide, limit the number of choices, because that would be already to make a value judgment. Another mistake doctors make, which is to only present what they think are the good choices. The idea at this point is you want to present all the options and the risks, benefits, and at least from the data, from the literature, what we know about it. Again, that's a probabilistic problem. You know, p-value is 0.05, 5% of everything that's in the library is wrong by definition. So the question is, this is a probabilistic idea, but the idea is, and it's a value judgment even picking what literature to read, but we try to make it as value-free as possible, okay? So we've decided what is going on and what can be done. Then the next question is, who should decide? Who should decide, which is an ethical question in its own right. And to give you the quick approach that we do, because I want to move forward, an adult person who has capacity. By the way, capacity is different from competence, which is a talk I often give in geriatrics. Competence is a legal term. Capacity is a clinical term. Incapacity means understanding the nature and consequences of the problem. By the way, the question is never, does the patient have capacity? I get called all the time. Does this patient have capacity? The question is never, does the patient have capacity? The question is, does this patient have the capacity to make this decision at this time under the circumstances? It's always a functional question. It's not a general question. You may have the capacity, as you all know more than anybody, you may have the capacity to decide whether you want Fruit Loops or Rice Krispies, but not manage your financial affairs. Okay, so it's in different spheres. So an adult person with capacity can make their own decision. And for another day, we'll talk about refusing treatment, which is almost absolute, versus demanding treatment, which is most of the consults I get these days are people demanding treatment. And obviously, there's justice questions, and that's a whole other discussion, a futility question, et cetera. But adult people with capacity make their own decisions, right? And we follow them. Person who no longer has capacity but had capacity at some point, who should decide, or how do we decide? What should be done and who should decide kind of comes together. Okay, so we try to do what's called a substituted judgment. And this is, we try to do what the patient would have wanted had they had capacity. And the only reason why this works is because they did have capacity at some point. And that's what advanced directives are all about. Okay, it's a fiction because we don't know exactly at that moment what they want. But the idea is we try to ask people when they had capacity what they would have wanted, or more importantly, who should be making the decisions for them if they become incapacitated, which is a much more better thing than writing down specifically what you want, because you can't decide, you know, you don't know exactly what situation you're going to be in. It causes more problems it's another lecture, but living wills are not very helpful. George Anderson, I wrote the law for the Massachusetts on healthcare proxies. We purposely didn't put anything in there about, that's all you need is to say, this is the person I want to make decisions for me, and they have the authority to make any decision against treatment or for treatment. So living wills tend to deal with what you don't want. But here, the idea is that you assign that person, and if you assign them while you had capacity, when you become incapacitated, that's the person who we go to. Okay, that's called a substituted judgment. Okay. But I think that that a document like that and having that discussion is good to give to your proxy. But I think that giving by stipulating what you want and what you don't want is problematic before you get into that situation. So I just think it's unnecessary and it can cause more confusion. But it's a whole long discussion. Okay, so that's a person who has capacity, who no longer has capacity. We try to do what's called a substituted judgment. And we often use these advanced directives or whatever those mean. Somebody who is incapacitated, who's always been incapacitated, someone with retardation, for instance, how do we decide what should be done for them or who should decide? Can't do a substitute judgment because they never had capacity. The best interest is the classic, right? Much like a parent does to a child. There, the question is who speaks in the best interest? And usually we like to have what's called a bonded surrogate, which is somebody who has a relationship, has some interest. And that becomes problematic because you can't assign the proxy, but we usually take a family member. But it's the person who has at heart what's in your best interest. Now remember, the goal of the healthcare proxy is to do what you would have wanted, not what they want. Whereas the surrogate decision maker for somebody who is incapacitated is to do what they think is in your best interest, which is a burden-benefit analysis, weighing the burdens and weighing the benefits. Okay, so that's the best interest, and that requires an analysis. The next level is somebody who has incapacity, who's always been incapacitated, and there is no bonded surrogate. So I'm asked by the court sometimes to be with a state in the state school where there's somebody about a life-sustaining treatment. And what's the standard we use there? Kind of the generic best interest, which we often call the reasonable person standard. Okay, it's like, you know, that's the most difficult situation because you don't know, you don't have any evidence. So we start off with the person who has capacity, and they have the right to make their own decisions, right? With some limits on demanding treatment, but certainly you can refuse anything. We have the notion of substituted judgment, which is somebody who is incapacitated, who had capacity at some point. We have somebody who's always been incapacitated, the best interest standard, and then a reasonable person standard. Okay, so that's the who should decide part. Now, what should be done is a part of the principled argument, and we generally use various principles of medical ethics, principles such as autonomy, principles such as benefit and harm, principles such as distributive justice. These are the things that have to be done in the context of a case. But as we balance the issue of autonomy. So autonomy and beneficence have often been seen as what kind of problem? The balancing of autonomy versus beneficence as the problem of paternalism. Right? And so the question is, there's strong paternalism, there's weak paternalism. Strong paternalism is where we say we know what's in your interest better than you, even though you have capacity. Whereas if you don't have capacity, then paternalism is much more justified, obviously, right? So this is the whole discussion about when, if ever, is paternalism justified. But this comes up a lot, okay? This comes up a lot. Now the question of capacity, which is the big point where we say people make their decisions or they don't make decisions, is also rather important. And so one of the things we do know is that capacity is an assessment, it's an independent assessment and not a function of outcome. So you and I all get called all the time for a patient who comes in. In fact, I just saw a consult recently, a woman who had a gangrenous, actually it's a very interesting story. This is a woman who was from the Deep South, and she was, God knows how old she was. She was in her 80s or 90s. You know, she was born on, as you know, I care for refugees, and they're all born on January 1st. You know that, right? Because, you know, they were born in the rainy season, so they give them January 1st. So this woman was born, you know, a long time. And she lived in a small town outside of Alabama. She never left that place. And she was into roots, and she never went to doctors. She didn't like doctors. And so she did pretty well. And she came up to see her great-grandniece here in Roxbury. It was the first time she left. And a great-grandniece looked at her foot and said, my God, there's something horrible going on here. And she said, I don't want to go to the doctor. I don't want to go. And she put her in, took her to the hospital. Okay? So this is the issue of, does she have the right to make decisions? She coerced her, right? And she arrived in the emergency room, and the surgeons looked at her foot and said, my God, you got a gangrenous toe. We need to amputate your foot. First of all, we need to admit you to the hospital. She said, I'm not going to the hospital. And her niece said, you're going to the hospital. So she went in the hospital. Okay, again, the issue of capacity. Did she? So then she's in the hospital, and the surgeons come by and say, we got to take off your foot. She says, I'm going to take it off my foot. In fact, I went and talked to her. She said, I came into this world with my foot. I'm going out of this world with my foot. sounded pretty good. Okay, now, of course, the surgeons called me and said what?
Capacity.
No, not even worse than that.
She doesn't have capacity.
In fact, had she signed an operative consent form, I guarantee you they would have taken her foot. Right? However, if she didn't have capacity, which is what they were arguing, she has no capacity to sign the consent form to have her foot taken off or not to have her foot taken off. She doesn't understand. Because otherwise, what capacity is no different than you have to agree with your doctor. If you agree with your doctor, then you have capacity, and if you don't agree with your doctor, right? So this is not a function of outcome. It's a function of the decision itself. But we have all kinds of complicated questions about capacity, which come up all the time in geriatrics, about somebody who's in a nursing home and just fine, and then we see this all the time. They come to the hospital, and they're in a different environment, and they become disoriented. And it appears as if they have incapacity. But if you can ground them, and if you can bring the people that knew them, et cetera, all of a sudden they kind of clear up. Okay. So the issue is we try to promote capacity to the best we can so that people can make their own decisions. Okay. After we decided what the problem is, it's an ethical problem, what is going on, what can be done, who should decide, and what should be done, then what do? We implement the decision, right? We implement the decision. That's the difference between here and the philosophy department. And by definition, we never have the answer to all those questions. You never have the answer to what's going on completely. You never have the answer. So there's always decision-making under uncertainty. But decisions have to be made, right? When they used to do the skits, they used to always have me as a character that somebody would come in and say, should we do this? And they'd say, I'll go back to my office for the next 3 weeks and think about it, and I'll come back. You can't do that, right? Decisions have to be made. The next big mistake doctors make is to implement the decision and then to be fixed after they've implemented the decision. Because after you've implemented a decision, what is going on has just changed. And so it's an iterative process. So you have to continually reevaluate. So I'll get the call all the time from the ICU saying, can we disconnect the ventilator? I say, no, you really mean, should we disconnect the ventilator? But the question is, well, why not? And they say, well, my God, she's been here for 3 weeks. How can we do it now? And the answer, of course, is 3 weeks ago it might have been indicated that that was what you wanted, that's what it looked, but it's like 3 weeks later. And here's another pearl. Machines don't have lives, people have lives. You don't have to use any technology. The technology only needs to be used in proportion to the burden or benefit to the person, right? So things change. What looked like a good idea at the beginning may not be such a good idea now. What you did because you refuse to do it doesn't mean you can't have it later. Those are independent assessments that have to be evaluated in and of themselves. Okay. Now, here's the key take home. This is worth the price of admission. If you do these four things, you'll almost never get into trouble. This is like pretty good. I'm giving you the whole thing. So first of all, always aim to benefit the patient. Always aim to benefit the patient. When people get into trouble, and I've been doing these consults for 30 years, people get into trouble when they start to aim to benefit themselves, benefit the institution, benefit. That doesn't mean you shouldn't take those into consideration, but always be patient-focused. Aim to benefit the patient. Two, get voluntary informed understanding consent from the person and or their surrogate or whatever. Voluntary informed understanding consent. Okay? Communicate all this, the process, what is going on, what can be done with the group, so everybody's there. I tell you that probably 90% of my consults are communication problems. Okay, that doesn't mean there aren't ethical problems. There are ethical problems, but I get in and I say, what seems to be the problem? And that's the problem. Is that even such things as like, what's the diagnosis? And this was the first time everybody was in one room. And you say, what do you think the problem? Well, the family has one sense of what the problem is. So communication is critical. All right? And that's three. And then for four is document. Okay? Document it. It's not as much for you, but document it so everybody sees what the process was and everybody can understand what went on. Okay? And that's the best you can do. But that's pretty damn good. If you always aim to benefit the patient, you get voluntary informed understanding consent, you communicate, and you document, you'll do fine. We have three goals for today. One was to recognize what's an ethical dilemma in medicine. Choice between the least used possible choice of action where people place significant different values. Excellent. If you learn that, you learned a lot. Because you can't answer those problems purely by the facts. You can get as much information and data in the world, but you're never going to answer that question because it's a value judgment. All right? The data is going to be critical, but the data is not going to solve this problem. Docs often try to get more data, but that's not going to solve this problem. Okay? So that's recognizing what an ethical dilemma is. And it's going to require arguments, justification. Okay? The second one was to distinguish law and religion from ethics. Law sets minimal standards. Law is jurisdictional. The law is not the same thing as ethics. Law tries to set the standards to maintain order, but law is supposed to be clear and effective and it's enforceable. Ethics deals with the nature and justification of principles that decide what should or not be done, and religion comes from faith in a revealed source. Okay? And the third goal we learned today was at least a start to some procedural and substantive principles to try to resolve these questions. The procedural one is define the problem, what is going on, what can be done, who should decide, what should be done, implement and reevaluate. And some of the substantive principles we alluded to were principles like autonomy, benefit, justice, utility, deontology, etc. Okay? All right. I think that's a lot. We just covered an enormous amount. But those are the three things that I want you to take away. And really what you need to do is have a case and see how this all gets flushed out and works.